Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. You don't lose your house. Call 1-877-462-7555. We are now joined. This is the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides. It'll be on the American Experience. The documentary will be on tonight. We've interviewed the maker of that film before. We've talked to many Freedom Riders here on the show. I was myself a Freedom Rider when I was a kid, but here in Maryland,
that's
Route
right.
40. It is unbelievable thing that it's 50 years ago that this took place, and they took place 100 years after the beginning of the Civil War. And we are joined by two men who risked their lives to do the Freedom Rides in 1961 through Mississippi and Alabama. We are joined by the Reverend Reginald Green, who served for more than 40 years as pastor of the Walker Memorial Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., and he boarded a Trailways bus in 1961 when he was a student at Virginia Union University in Richmond, and was arrested and jailed for 23 days in Mississippi. Hank Thomas was a student at Howard University and was on board the bus that was firebombed, and we all remember that picture vividly. Those of you who have seen it, you can't forget it. Was on board the bus that was firebombed in Anniston, Alabama, on Sunday, May 14th, 1961, 50 years ago, a few days ago. And so Hank Thomas and Reverend Reginald Green, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, Mark.
So tell us, starting, I guess we'll start with Reginald Green and go to Hank Thomas. Tell us your stories about what drove you both as young men, students, to join the Freedom Riders, the Congress for Racial Equality, jump on those buses from your universities and make that journey, which you knew was going to be potentially a very dangerous journey. Reginald Green, and then we'll go to Hank Thomas.
Okay. Well, it's very interesting since you have Hank on the phone as well.
Yes.
It is really because of what I saw as a result of that bus in Anniston that Hank was on, that I saw these images of these persons being firebombed, that bus exploding, the things that came across the newspapers, the media. And as a student who had been involved in the sit-ins in Richmond, it seemed like a logical conclusion for me that if I wanted to make some change, I got to be a participant in it. And because of that image we saw, and I saw, two other students and I from Virginia Union decided we'd become part of that wave of Freedom Riders that got on the bus in Richmond, Virginia, going to Mississippi to be a part of the Freedom Ride movement. It was that, and Hank knows I've said this to him on occasions, that it's because of what I saw happening to him and others that drew me to become a part of the Freedom Ride movement.
Hank Thomas?
Well, let me put it for those your audience here. Let's put things in a historical perspective.
Please do.
We had an apartheid system in this country. We called it Jim Crow. We called it segregation. But for all practical purposes, it was apartheid. Now, that word apartheid is somewhat anathema to most Americans because you associate it with this oppressive regime in South Africa. Now, we should remember that the segregation laws here, or the black codes, gave birth to the apartheid laws of South Africa, and also gave birth to the Nuremberg laws of Germany. And we, of course, know what that eventually led to. But Jews had to get off the street when Germans had to get off the sidewalk when Germans were there. Jews could not ride the public transportation, or they had to get in the back. Well, that's what happened with us. Everything about our lives in the South as black people were prescribed and governed by racist laws telling us what we could and could not do. So when we say we rose up against an oppressive regime, I want people to picture what's going on in the Middle East when it was in Tunisia, when it was in Egypt, that the Arabs rose up against their oppressive regime. And what you will see and what we did, this is what young people, and especially college people, will do. All revolutions, certainly in modern times, have been led by college students, the educated ones who see the hypocrisy between what goes on in their lives and what's written either in a country's constitution and things of that nature. So it was a question of, I saw something wrong like hundreds and thousands of other blacks, and we thought it was time to act, and we only needed that spark that was lit by the Greensboro four freshmen to say, okay, enough is enough. But I'm pretty sure others did what I had done in their own way. They were rebelling against the Jim Crow laws, whether you had to drink from a colored fountain right beside a white fountain. There were some who did not do that. So when I took that ride on the Greyhound bus, of course, I'd already been participating in the sit-in, it was just another hill that I was going to fight on in order to dismantle the system.
Now, Hank, let me ask you a question, and I want Anthony to jump in as well and then go back to Reginald Green. But I want you to describe, please, just for our listeners, what it was like to be on that bus on May 14th, 1961, in Anniston, Alabama, when it was firebombed and attacked.
Yeah, this is one day plus of that 50th anniversary. First of all, I thought I was going to die. We had this bus that was being had been attacked when we first pulled into the bus station there. Windows were being broken out, and they could not get aboard the bus because you could lock the door from the inside. And so when the bus driver got off, that's what he did. So they couldn't get to us on the bus. Unbeknownst to us, they'd cut the tires to disable the bus, so when the bus driver got back on the bus and tried to pull out of the bus station and get back onto the streets, he could only go about 15 miles an hour because the bus was sandwiched in the front and in the back by cars and pickup trucks of the Klan, the terrorist group, and because they knew that that bus was going to have to stop sooner or later. 3 or 4 miles out of town, the bus tires did go flat. And again, the bus driver jumped off the bus and for his own safety. I don't blame him for that. But he had the forethought to lock the door as he got out, so they still could not get aboard. Well, they had finished breaking out all of the windows in the bus, and they obviously became frustrated. So somebody had bought a firebomb with them, I guess to say, well, if we don't get on one way, we're going to do it another. So they threw this incendiary grenade through the back window, and in just a matter of seconds, the bus started to burn and fill up with smoke. Well, in just a few seconds, I had to make a decision, and I knew that at age 19, I was about to die.
19.
And it was a question of what's the easiest way to die. If I got off that bus and went out into the mob, I was going to be beaten to death. If I stayed on, I was going to be burned to death, so I figured out how I was going to do it. I thought that if I took a deep breath and breathed in that toxic smoke, it would put me to sleep, and that's the way I was going to die. So for all practical purposes, I decided that I had to commit suicide just to figure, just to get an easy way to die. But I certainly thought that that was going to be the end of me. Luckily for us, the flames reached the fuel tank of the bus in the rear, and that fuel tank blew up. And when it blew, then everybody who was around that bus scattered, and that's the way we got off because they were holding the door. When they saw that we were trying to get off the bus, you know, I could hear them say, hey, let's burn them niggas alive. And basically, they were holding the door to keep us from getting off the bus. So that Klan mob was ready to murder 14 people on that bus. Why? Because blacks and whites were sitting together. That's something that's hard for Americans today to believe, but that was Alabama and the South 50 years ago.
Reverend Green, this is Anthony McCarthy. I'm very curious. I grew up in Virginia. I'm a Virginia boy. And I'm very curious about when you decided that you were going to get on that Trailways bus in 1961, a student of the great University of Virginia Union. Did you talk to your parents about the decision you made?
No, that's very interesting. I tell this story about how my dad discovered that I was in jail in Mississippi. A reporter from the Evening Star. We used to have three major newspapers here in the city.
Uh-huh.
Washington Post was a morning paper. The Evening Star was the evening paper. And then we had a Washington Daily News. Well, a reporter from the Evening Star, somehow they got the names of who those persons were from this area that were part of the riots, and my name came up, and he contacted my dad. My dad relayed this story to me that he wanted to know if he had a son named Reginald Green. And my dad, of course, said yes. And then my dad volunteered some more information, as he told me. And he told the reporter that, well, my son won't be home for the summer because he's in Richmond, Virginia, working so that he might return to school in September for the summer. And that's when the reporter relayed to him the fact that I was in jail in Mississippi. I was one of the Freedom Riders that had joined the rides in early June, and that he finally got a letter from me about 3 days later, which then I hope eased his mind. But that's how he discovered that I was in jail. Now, why I didn't tell him, you know, I was 21 years old, so I was an adult, so I didn't have to. But out of respect and appreciation of my generation for parents, rather than tell them because I was concerned that my father and mother might say, no, don't do this, we're worried for you, and I could understand that. But instead, I opted not to tell them and then use my courage, my faith, and my strength and be willing to take the risk, having learned of what had happened in Anniston particularly. And that's how I made the decision to join the riots.
And there were a lot of people in that time who were trying to stop the riots, and people who believed in civil rights and civil rights leaders were trying to say, don't do this, you're provoking, you're pushing, this is not the way to do it. But the Freedom Riders and CORE and SNCC said, no, we're continuing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And as the thing was, because the riots almost ended after the situation in Alabama. And Hank can address that even more than I can. And but because of what happened in Nashville, a new wave of riders started coming through that Nashville group with Diane Nash and some of the others there. I joined that later group that came in, and at that point, because the Mississippi governor had said what happened in Alabama was not going to happen here, we'll arrest them, put them in jail, and maybe they'll learn a lesson. Maybe they'll give up that way. But it was already on going on now, and there were far too many of us willing to come. And so many riders came from all parts of this country to be a part of it then. And that's what the story of these Freedom Rides are all about, how we were able to take in the risk, being willing even to make our wills, be willing to make this ride because we knew, as Hank said, it was time. We've had enough of it. It's what Fannie Lou Hamer said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I think that's the message of the Freedom Rides, even as we look back 50 years.
Hank Thomas, let me ask you about, because it's, I'm 40, and it is almost storied, the Freedom Rides that took place. And my grandmother told me about them. My mom has talked to me about them. And I've seen clips from this documentary. What kind, for our listeners, what kind of preparation was done to prepare you, later to prepare Pastor Green, for the danger? I was amazed at some of the clips I saw where people knew that people were prepared to die when they got on those buses, whites and blacks sitting beside each other, bus drivers terrified as they made their way to the South. What kind of preparation, what kind of talk? Pastor Green just talked about people, young people, 18, 19, 20 years old, preparing their wills.
Yes, that was true. We knew the reputation of the South, the reputation of Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and Louisiana. We knew that black folks' lives were basically worthless to white Klansmen and those terror organizations. And whenever you went up against that particular system, and I'm going to flip back and forth because I want people to get true picture of what America was like.
Sure.
In certain countries in the Middle East, in certain countries in Europe that had dictatorships, you stood up and said anything against that dictatorship in Germany or in Russia, your life was in danger, and many people died as a result of just saying something against a particular government. Well, that same thing happened here when black people dared to stand up and take a stand when they tried to vote. They were killed. Some of them were killed. We knew that. But like all freedom fighters, you know the risk of opposing an oppressive government can mean your life. If you're not willing to do that, and if men and women had not been willing to do that before us, then no progress would have been made insofar as social justice was concerned. Before we went on that freedom ride and before we sat in at the lunch counters, there were black people who were murdered in the South who dared to go up and register the vote. So having a fear of death was something you had to overcome. Now, the training we had, because we had to, our tactic was that of nonviolence. And why nonviolence? Some people believed it as a philosophy and lived that way. I did not. But you had to do that, and I'll tell you why. Let's say I'm sitting there at the lunch counter and three or four guys come and start beating me up. If I then defend myself, which is the normal human reaction, and the police come, guess what the police is going to do? The police is going to shoot me because they're going to say that I hit a white man. And we all knew that. So in order to make absolutely certain not to give the police a reason, not that they needed one, but a clear reason not to shoot you, you cannot appear to be defending yourself. Your best defense, if you will, is to take those blows and just get beaten up, and that's really what we did. Now, there were some people whose philosophy of nonviolence said, I will use my non-resistance, hoping that it will touch the heart of that person. Well, it didn't do that. But you saved your life, perhaps, from being shot by the police by not fighting back.
And, you know, I think when people hear this who didn't live through the era, didn't see it, it's almost hard to fathom.
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was America then.
Yeah.
Okay. We've well, Reg and I did, and so many hundreds of others. We changed the country to where it is today that you now made it possible for Barack Obama to be elected president of this country. And the generation of young people, people of your age today, and it's a wonderful thing that you didn't have to witness that, to go through that, even a black or a white person. And that's the kind of country that we turn this into today. Where we do have freedom, relatively speaking, for all people.
Well, my dear friend and colleague here, Anthony McCarthy, who is a young man about 40, but I'm closer to your age and did live through it. So
you don't sound like it.
See, I'd like to add a little.
Reginald, go ahead.
Carry on to what Hank was talking about,
mm-hmm.
And that is, and I've often thought about this over the years, and that is that though there's clearly evident of the courage and the risk-taking that these riders took, including Hank as one and me later in the process. The folks we never ought to forget is that when the rides finally are over and we're able to return to our several places, many of us, the folks who had to steal, either because of economics, had to still live in Mississippi, in those places, were those who had great courage because their lives were at risk, their children's lives were at risk. They were taking those risks of loss of property if they had any. So all those things are part of this whole episode that we ought not forget in the process. And I always said those who remained in Mississippi had to live there and made it through this whole time period were people of great strength.
Amen, Reggie. Amen three times. You're absolutely correct. Now, another group that we owe as black folks a special debt of gratitude to. The very first time I ever walked on a picket line outside of Washington, D.C. in Glen Echo, Maryland.
Oh, yes.
Most people on that picket line were Jews. Right. Two people on that picket line former inmates of Auschwitz. The three civil rights workers that were killed in Mississippi, two of them were Jews.
Right.
On that bus where the 13 of us went down to on that first Freedom Rider, that first group, there were seven whites, and four of those whites were Jews. And I say, lest we forget that.
Yeah.
Jews have been our most steadfast allies in our civil rights struggle for human rights and dignity. Long before we started direct action, the founding of the NAACP at what was called the Niagara Movement, you had Jews involved. All of the black colleges today can count among their list of philanthropists Jews who wrote sizable checks. So Jews have always been involved with us. And I always say this to audiences, lest we forget Jerusalem. And I say this whenever I get an opportunity to my Jewish brothers and sisters, I will never, never, ever forget Jerusalem.
And you know for sure, as a pastor of 40 years ministry, understand that very clearly. And that is, had it not been for that combination, that multiplicity of talents, of ethnicities, of races, of religious backgrounds, and some without religious backgrounds, the fact that we had a coming together,
yes,
like I said, with that population, that Jewish population has been there for us, we would not have been able to succeed in this whole Freedom Ride movement.
Yes, indeed.
God, for the grace of God, and those persons of goodwill, young and old, white, black, Jewish, Gentile, we were able to bring down some signs that were about human degrading and taking away our humanity, just because of the physical appearance of those signs. That's it, colored only, white only.
There is, I watched some clips of some Jewish women who talk about their experience and how it has impacted their entire lives. It's impacted how they raise their children, how they see themselves in the world, their involvement in these freedom rides. Either one of you, I'm not sure who to ask, and I'm amazingly emotional about this whole thing. What was the strategy of making sure to include women, young women, in this movement, in this Freedom Ride movement? What was there a strategy? I mean, did we think that maybe they would be treated better if they were part of the delegation?
I really don't know if I never gave that a great deal of thought. It's just natural to me. But I have heard some of the older folks said that we wanted to include some women because that might restrain some of the mob and the attackers. And I imagine in some cases it did, but in other cases women were also attacked. But you know, I never thought of it, you know, consciously of saying, hey, we got to include women, because the women were always there from the very beginning, as far as I can remember. What about you, Reginald?
My thought is, without knowing the details, the fact that it took this pairing, male and female, to make this thing work.
Okay.
Women were taking a kind of risk unlike what we might have been taking as males.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it took great strength, courage, and faith to get on those buses. And you would think that after hearing, for example, in my case, what happened in Anniston, think the logical thing would happen, saying, well, I'm not going to get into that. So you could have opted to go two ways with this thing. We opted to go forward as participants. And there are many who, based on their temperament, their attitudes, could not have done it, and that well. But the fact is, it took these 400-some persons who got on these buses and trains and coming from all across the country to help sort of continue a process of liberation of this nation.
Yeah. And let me say this, that now that President Barack Obama is in the White House, it is only a matter of time. Yes, this country will have a woman president, and it will have a Jewish president. And let's hope to God that when we have a Jewish president, that Donald gonna come up and say that he was born in Israel. Okay.
Why is our mind working together?
Before
the one point I wanted to make, though, is that when you look back, you know, 50 years, 1961, summer of 1961, what happened? The Freedom Riders go on the bus. They ride that summer. In August 4th, 1961, who's born?
Barack Obama.
Barack, the President of the United States.
Yeah.
Also, early on in the 60s, when all this was going on, there were words from Robert Kennedy suggesting that sometime soon there will be a Negro, as the term was used then, in the White House.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that. You're absolutely
correct.
That's
right. That's right.
We thought he had been drinking too much.
That may be true. Who knows?
I want to say to both of you, first of all, and Hank Thomas, I want to tell our listeners as well, was a Freedom Rider, is also a wounded Vietnam veteran.
Yes.
Has served our country two ways. And both these gentlemen have been fighters for civil rights their whole lives, the Reverend Reginald Green and Hank Thomas. And I would look forward to having the two of you back on our program again one day to talk about what lessons we learned from that for the future. The next time we get together, I'd love to do that.
Can I make one final comment?
We have about a minute left, yes.
And that is, I need to say this to Hank, as I do to John Lewis so often. For me, those two men, among others, are real standard bearers for what went on. And Hank, it is because of what we saw happen to you that so many of us decided to get on the bus. And we need to thank you for helping us make that decision.
Amen.
I just wanted to say that.
Reverend Green, that's very kind of you, and I do appreciate that. Thank you.
And I go along with Reverend Green. I remember that day and why I marched as well for the same reasons. And you gentlemen, I want to thank you both so much for what you've done for our country, Reverend Reginald Green and Hank Thomas. And remind you, tonight at 9 o'clock, you can see the documentary, Stanley Nelson's documentary, Freedom Riders, tonight on the American Experience at 9 p.m. here in Maryland, on Maryland Public Television. And when you go to our website, you can also hear a conversation we had with Stanley Nelson last year about his documentary, Freedom Riders, and other work we've done.
And the Freedom Riders will gather in Mississippi May 22nd through the 26th to celebrate the 50th anniversary. We will gather in Jackson, Mississippi.
Amen to that. I hope I could be there for that. That would be gentlemen, thank you both so much for everything you've done.
Thank you
very much.
We look forward to talking to you. Thank you so much. And Anthony McCarthy, thank you for being with me here
today. Awesome, Mark. Awesome.
We want you to stay tuned. We come back from this break. You'll hear a really fascinating conversation with Michelle Alexander, the law professor who wrote The New Jim Crow, about her editorial in the New York Times, about don't be fooled by conservatives saying they want prison reform. Stay with us. We'll be right back.